Wondery Plus subscribers can listen to How I Built This early and ad-free right now. Join Wondery Plus in the Wondery app or on Apple Podcasts.
Conan O'Brien was promised to take over The Tonight Show. And so I was leaving and Lauren goes, would you ever want to host a late night, you know, because you could take over Conan in 6 years? And we were kind of laughing. And I asked my wife, she goes, are you kidding? Yes, you have to do this. You're on a list. There's David Letterman, Conan O'Brien, and you. That's it. That's wow. An amazing list to be on. You have to, without a doubt. And so I said, I called Lauren, I go, yes, I want to do this. And he's like, okay, great. Now I just got to convince NBC.
Welcome to How I Built This, a show about innovators, entrepreneurs, idealists, and the stories behind the movements they built. I'm Guy Raz, and on the show today, how Jimmy Fallon dreamed of a career in comedy and became an icon of late-night TV with a side hustle as a serial entrepreneur. A few years ago, I received a call from a producer on The Tonight Show. She wanted to know if I could come to New York the next week and appear as a guest. Once I cut through my minor panic and heart palpitations, I asked, why me? Well, to my great surprise and delight, she told me Jimmy Fallon was a fan of the show. Turns out he's obsessed with stories about founders. Over the years, I've had a few more opportunities to come on his show and talk about some of the founders we've had on this show, and usually Jimmy pitches me on a bunch of his business ideas. He's wanted to make toaster waffles embedded with emojis, cheese slices shaped like circles so they fit better on hamburgers, and even vitamins in eyedrop form. And some of his ideas have turned into real products. For example, if you wear glasses, you might find yourself fidgeting with them from time to time, twirling them around by the arms. Jimmy invented a pair of glasses where the hinge is on a ball bearing that twirls. And Warby Parker actually produced them. All the proceeds, like most of the products Jimmy sells or endorses, go to charity. Anyway, one of the things I noticed about Jimmy and the Tonight Show crew is that it is an incredibly well-oiled machine. But more importantly, every single person associated with the show, whether it was a page who brought me up the elevator, to the security team at check-in, to the bookers, to the segment producers, to the makeup crew, to Jimmy himself, each person is incredibly kind. Like, so kind you notice it. And that's not by accident. The person you see on TV every night delivering a monologue or dressing up as a character and singing or playing a game with a celebrity, he really seems to be exactly that person off-screen as well. Jimmy Fallon is interested in the people he talks to. He almost always has a story to tell, and he's usually laughing. And he happens to have built an incredible brand around his personality, even if it wasn't intentional or part of a plan. Jimmy Fallon is now one of the most important drivers of revenue for NBC. And outside of his relentless job as host of The Tonight Show, he somehow manages to run a production company that produces several TV shows, he writes children's books, records music, and is constantly coming up with new business ideas. Like all the people I've had on this show, Jimmy Fallon is an entrepreneurial thinker. He's restless, always needing to create something new. But as a kid, he was also super focused, almost hyper-focused, on one unwavering goal: to one day become a cast member on Saturday Night Live. He even knew the name of the executive producer, Lorne Michaels. Jimmy grew up in the 70s and 80s in upstate New York in a middle-class Irish Catholic family. And early on, in order to learn everything he could about comedy and performing, he invested in some serious high-end technology.
Garage sales were like a happening thing in the 80s. And so I went to this garage sale and I bought a reel-to-reel recorder, a tiny one. And, you know, you could record with a reel-to-reel for hours.
Yeah.
So I would record radio shows. I would record TV. I would record Saturday Night Live. So if it was on and I was awake or watching it, I would record, you know, Steve Martin's monologue on a reel-to-reel, and then I'd have it, and so I could listen to it again and, like, memorize it and lip-sync it or perform it or pretend I'm Steve Martin and go, hey, okay, and now I'm going to do this, you know, and I want to, like, actually sound like him or do him or do Richard Pryor, you know, imitate exactly his joke and his timing, and that was, like, basically owning records, but I didn't have to spend the money on records. I could just tape it off the one speaker on my Heathkit television set.
Were you comfortable, like, just getting up in front of people, your parents, friends, kids at school, on stage at school, and just performing?
You know, I wasn't really. I'm trying to remember where it actually kind of flipped over. But, I mean, like, our grandparents used to live in our backyard. Well, not, like, in the yard. In a tent or
in a little house, yeah.
Yeah, exactly. They had them in a cage. We'd throw food at them. They had a little cottage kind of in the back, tiny.
Yeah.
So we'd have parties all the time. There was a lot of drinking and singing and crying and a lot of entertaining. Everyone would get up and sing something, you know. My parents would say, hey, would you and Gloria go do something or sing a song or do you have anything you want to, you
know. This is Gloria. Gloria's your sister.
Yeah, so we would perform and we would do these. The Saturday Night Live Czech Brothers, not even knowing what the jokes meant.
We cruise for them on our tight slacks, which give us great bulges.
We would be dressed in, like, the disco-iest outfits, you know, from my dad's closet or my mom's closet, and hats, floppy hats, and be like, we are two wild and crazy guys. And you know, we have to go to Statue of Liberty to get birth control devices.
They told us that in America, many American park rangers distribute birth control devices.
And my grandmother would be like, what are they talking? What are they saying? And we didn't know what that meant. I thought it was like a robot thing or something, device, a birth control device. I didn't know what jokes, but we were just doing it and we were getting laughs. So that was kind of a thing. Then, you know, I got into Rodney Dangerfield, you know, at an early age. And I would put on one of my dad's ties and I would just do his act. My wife's cooking so bad, you know. And this is a 10-year-old kid talking like this. My wife, her cooking is so bad. Since when does toast have bones, you know? All right. I think my parents would give me like $1, you know, or my grandparents would give me like 50 cents to do it, you know?
Yeah, I wonder, I mean, because you can make an analogy between a kid who's just really talented at a basketball or baseball. And there are kids like Mike Trout was an amazing youth baseball player, right? Like Bryce Harper, people knew that at the time. Did anybody, when you were 10, 11, 12, say to you or your parents, he's really talented? Like, this is not just funny, fun. Like, there's something here.
I don't know. You know, I don't think so. I remember I got some report card once that said, I smile too much, which is hilarious to me. He doesn't take things serious. I think they were kind of, was their point or something, because I would just laugh if someone said something to me, I think. But I do remember that report card coming back and like, what a weird thing for someone to say. I think it was kindergarten. Who would ever say your kid smiles too much? But that was a real actual report from my teacher. I do remember graduating from eighth grade. My yearbook said, and this is true, I can, if you can believe me over this podcast, I can somehow get a photo to you somehow, or maybe I'll tweet it when this airs, but it said most likely to replace David Letterman.
Amazing. Yeah, in eighth grade.
Eighth grade. And it's like, unless Nostradamus was my principal, you know, who would know?
Yeah.
But no one ever said, hey, he has a future. We didn't do that in our town. I mean, no one knew that you could get out of the... Your goals were kind of, I'm going to do what my dad does or something, you know, or what my mom does. But IBM was really the only thing happening in our little town. And so that was kind of a lot of people's goals, to work at IBM.
So I want to ask you about doing stand-up comedy, because that's where you would kind of start your career, right? And I think you started doing it pretty early. How did you get into stand-up?
Stand-up, I started in at like my senior year in high school. There was a radio contest of who can do the funniest impression in the Hudson Valley. And my mom heard about this on the radio, and she said, she came out to my room, she's like, I wrote this down, you have to do this contest, because I hear all the voices you do in your room, and you blah, 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 and I go, okay, let's do it. I'll enter this contest. And, you know, if she believed in me, you know. And I was 17 at the time. I think I had 1 minute to do any impression. And instead, I wanted to do as many impressions as I could in 1 minute. I think I ended up doing like 10 impressions. You know, Bill Cosby, Casey Kasem, Bullwinkle, John Travolta, you know. And I was basing it all off, someone gave me a troll doll as a graduation gift, like a good luck class of, you know, 1992. And it was a troll doll holding a diploma. And I thought that was very nice, but also, what am I going to do with this doll, you know? And so I remember doing different celebrities auditioning for a commercial for troll dolls. So I would do Travolta and go like, geez, like, you know, like, who does his hair? Like, what kind of doll is this? You know, his arms and legs don't even move, you know? And I remember at the time I was into Bullwinkle, and so I did Bullwinkle saying like, these trolls are nice, but I'd rather play with myself or something like that. And then I pulled out a Bullwinkle doll and I go, well, you know what I mean? You know, I'll play with the doll. And then I go, next up, Pee Wee Herman. And it was right when this scandal was coming out. Yeah. And I closed with Pee Wee going, I know what you mean. I like to play with myself too. And I did that, and that was my closer, and it was like topical, edgy, you know, all in 1 minute. And it's like, woo, I had a solid minute. And I ended up winning the contest. Yeah. And then I got the bug. The comedy club Bananas in Poughkeepsie, New York, they said, would you come MC? And so I used to work on weekends. My dad would drive me to gigs, and wow, I'd do stand up.
You knew, right, already in high school, that you wanted to be on Saturday Night Live. And
yeah,
you went to college, and eventually you dropped out. While you were in college, you were doing stand up, you were emceeing. I mean, were you methodical and intentional about it? I mean, were you thinking to yourself, this is like, I need to do this to get better and better? Or did you just love doing it, or was it both of those things?
Better and better, I think, was my first thing. Like, I got to just get better enough. So I kept, you know, having dreams of, like, Lorne Michaels calling me up, finding me in Albany and going, like, Jimmy, Dana Carvey's sick. We need you to come in, you know. And I go, done. I can do the church lady, you know, and whatever. And, you know, you think that way. You go, like,
yeah,
why would – no one would ever call someone to come in and replace the church lady or whatever Dana's bits, you know, that he's doing already. But that in my head, I pictured him doing that and going, that's the way I'm going to get on Saturday Night Live.
I mean, you when you dropped out of college, you decided to move to Los Angeles. You were 21. And you were moving out there with the single pursuit of just honing your craft, trying to get better and better. You had a plan in mind?
I worked at this local newspaper in Troy, New York, outside of Albany, called Metroland. And the owner of Metroland was this guy, Peter Islin, who was moving to L.A. to become a music manager. So he was leaving Albany to go to where Hollywood is, I mean, where the business was. So I was a secretary, so I would answer the phones. And he was leaving, and I said, hey, if you see anybody, here's my headshot and my tape of my troll act that I was doing in college, my troll doll act. I go, if you see anybody, and he goes, I'm not doing comedy, but okay, I'll take it with me. And he took it with him to L.A., and he worked at this company, and there was this woman that worked there called, her name was Randy Siegel, and she worked for a manager named Ray Rio at Brillstein Gray. Now that's a lot of names, mm-hmm. but let me mm-hmm. explain something. Bernie Brillstein and Brad Gray were the biggest entertainment managers in the business. And anyone who knew anything about Saturday Night Live at the time, a lot of cast members were on the roster of Brillstein Gray. So I go, oh my gosh, if any connection to Brillstein Gray,
yeah,
that's my step in. This is getting closer and closer, Jimmy. This is something. So Randy called me in Albany and said, Jimmy Fallon, this is Randy Siegel. She goes, I think you have something, and I think you have to come out to L.A. immediately because it's a thing called pilot season, and this is when people try out for shows, and you could get a sitcom and blah, blah, blah. And she goes, yeah, I think you're a little green, but we could work on your act, and I think we can get you onto something. I think you're very castable, and you're likable and funny. And I go, I don't really want to be on a sitcom, though. I want to be on Saturday Night Live. And she was like, okay, all right. Well, I mean, good. That's great. I mean, hey, if you can do that, fantastic. But let's audition for other shows just so you can get used to this thing. We'll work on getting it, you know, Saturday Night Live. Like, you know, that's a long shot. And so I go, all right, I'm just going to call my parents and say, hey, I got this opportunity and I don't think it's going to come again. And I borrowed all the money I could borrow, $3,000 maybe, from my dad. My grandparents lent me money, and I moved out to L.A. I flew out on some airline that doesn't exist anymore.
Right.
But they were like, just get out here now. You could sleep on the couch and just go to auditions, and this is the way you're going to do it. And I go, okay.
So when you got out there, when you got out to L.A., what do you remember? What was it like? What did you do?
I lived on another one of the manager's couches. I slept on his couch in his living room for probably about a month and a half or 2 months until I could find a place of my own and see how I can afford. I didn't have a car because my dad was like, you can't afford it and you can't drive out and all this stuff. And that was a really big mistake because in L.A.,
yeah,
you need a car to go anywhere.
Yeah.
You can't go across the street without driving. You go, wait, I can see. They go, I know you can see it, but you can't get there. I mean, in L.A., they go, I know the best place to go for a walk. You go, where? They go, take the 405 to the 101. And you go, oh, no, I have to drive to get to the place you walk? So I'm like, everything's driving. So I'm like, that was a mistake. But I used to get rides and then go to the club early and just wait and stay there until it's my time to go on stage, you know.
And you would just do any stand-up gig you could get?
Anything. I did any gig I can get. The Improv was my home club. I auditioned for them, and so they said, yes, so you'll get like a Thursday night spot or something like that. And I go, okay. So Thursday night, they put you up 10:45 or 11 o'clock at night, and you get paid $7.13 or something weird and technical like that. I still have one of the check stubs. And you just work on your act, and you keep showing up. And if you do well, they invite you back, and you do next Thursday, and it becomes a steady gig. And you do Wednesday and Thursday, and then you get invited to do a weekend gig, a Saturday gig.
Yeah.
And that one, you get paid like $8. Big step up.
Did you spend a lot of time at night writing down material? I mean, But basically, you're going to get better and better and better. And sometimes you're going to really suck, right, on stage. But over time, you're going to get more confident.
Yes, that's what it's all about, just honing the act and tinkering and changing one little bit and one thing or one. If something gets a laugh, you know. I remember I videotaped my act, you know.
Wow.
And sometimes I would even just carry the video camera in my guitar case and record the audio of my act. And I would listen to my act all day long the next day and analyze it. As a comedian, you have nothing really to do during the day. So during the day, I just watched, you know, General Hospital or, you know, Price is Right. And then I just work on bits and work on impressions and work on what lines I thought would be, oh, that's sticking out of my head or that's a good bit. I guess, which is kind of what I was doing, you know, when I was a kid, you know, in my bedroom.
Yeah. You would record yourself, watch it or listen to it. Which is really hard. I mean, that can be really painful, especially when you think you didn't perform well. Like even 25 years of doing this, it's hard for me to listen to myself. I do listen to the show and critique myself. It's hard because I kick myself. But like you read about athletes who sit in the screening room and just watch a game where they just sucked, and it's really hard. How did you do that? How did you get through listening to your performances?
You live and learn. You know, you do things that are hacky, and you go like, ugh, I know that gets a laugh, but I can't leave it in my act because it's too corny. And trying something that you think is going to be so funny and have it tank, and you're like, all right, I hope they invite me back because that one was rough. I remember once, guy, I thought it would be so, I think it was a showcase was a big deal. Like if HBO came to the Improv and they're going to watch new comedians, they would showcase like 5 comedians. And out of those 5, hopefully one person would get on HBO or something. And I remember not getting on those showcases, but if I was the first comedian on after that showcase, they're still in the room. So
yeah.
If I scored then, it's almost like being on the showcase, you know?
Yeah.
And I remember trying to grow my goatee as long as I could, or a beard or a mustache. And it's very wispy and embarrassing. But I did, and I went and I shaved on stage. It had nothing to do with my act, but in my brain I go, this is Andy Kaufman. This is so avant-garde. Everyone is going to talk about who is the guy that shaved on stage? That was genius, that bit. I didn't know. Dude, it was so overthought. And then I had to bring a bowl with, like, kind of water in it so I can get the shaving cream out of the razor. It was a disaster. It was on my face, and it was kind of burning after a while, and I didn't know if I was bleeding. It was so stupid, and I remember it was like the longest 10 minutes, and it just tanked. And I that was just one of the hundreds of times I've tanked in front of an audience.
But you have to go through that.
You actually have to go through it. And what happens eventually is years later, you miss those days, and you kind of laugh about those days, and I go, now I can talk to you about those days. At the time, I couldn't even walk back into the improv. I was so embarrassed. It was just the worst. But you have to do it. I mean, you have to.
Yeah.
It just builds your skill level. You're just like, if I can do this when the jokes aren't working, I can definitely do it when the jokes are working.
You within 2 years, you got an audition for SNL in 97.
Yeah.
Finally, you get your dream opportunity to audition.
It was every step of the way. I remember I enjoyed every step because I go, Jimmy, this is it. You might not make it past this, so just enjoy this because this is the story. But I remember going up, and I think I had 5 minutes or 7 minutes, and I knew from the first 30 seconds that it wasn't going to work. I couldn't latch onto the audience. They didn't. I couldn't catch the wave.
Couldn't connect with them.
I couldn't get the wave. I was like, I knew it. I was like, you know, I'm doing this troll doll thing. And Lorne was there. I saw him walk in. He had a baseball hat on and, you know, really pulled down. And he kind of sat in the darkness. And I think, you know, I just remember it did not go well. And I remember leaving. And there was a diner next door, and I just went to the diner next door and had coffee with my manager, and, you know, and it was sad. And it was like a depressing diner night. And so I just had to kind of get over it, and, you know, I probably cried. I don't know. I mean, this is a dream. Guy, this is all I ever wanted. I mean, this is...
Yeah.
Every time I cut into a birthday cake, I would wish for Saturday Night Live. Every time I threw a coin in a fountain, it was obsessive. And so it was crushing, and then I think I blocked it out and just kind of went back to work and go, okay, I got to improve this troll doll act.
you go back, and it's discouraging, but you in your mind know that you've got to go for this again. Like there's going to be, I mean, did you know there was going to be another chance?
I didn't. But in my head, I just kind of willed that I can't, that they're almost like they're making a mistake. They have to have me. Like they have to realize I will pay them to be on Saturday Night Live. You know, at the time, you know, I thought that would mean something. They have to realize I will do it for free.
When we come back in just a moment, Jimmy's remarkable run on Saturday Night Live, his not so remarkable film career, and the phone call that made him a star of late night TV. Stay with us. I'm Guy Raz, and you're listening to How I Built This. Hey, welcome back to How I Built This. I'm Guy Raz. So it's 1997, and Jimmy has just blown his audition for SNL in front of the show's creator, Lorne Michaels. And it seems like his dream job may never happen. But he does finally land a gig. It's a pilot for a TV show on the WB network.
The show is about a catering business, and I was like the delivery boy or something. And it was great experience. I loved it. It was called Tasty Sensations. And I just remember when I was doing my contract for that, and it was like, this is a big deal to get a pilot, the show that was about to air. And it was a big producer involved. And I remember signing the contract, and I said, can I just ask one thing? If I get Saturday Night Live, can I get out of this show? I remember them going, this is ridiculous. We're not going to put this in a contract. And then I think someone said to someone, let's just sign the contract. This guy's not going to get Saturday Night Live. And so they put an extra page in the contract. Never been done before, never been done since, I don't think. But saying, if I get Saturday Night Live, I get out of the show, out of my contract. It's all said and done.
And it's incredible that you got that clause into your contract, because in 1998, a year after your first audition, you got another audition for SNL. Yeah. And anybody listening should just Google Jimmy Fallon Saturday Night Live audition. It's so amazing to watch because you're so young and and so might be embarrassing for you to watch, or I don't know, maybe you cringe, but it's really lovely, and it's a really great impressions that you do on stage, Jerry Seinfeld and Chris Rock and you two. And how long did it take for you to find out whether you were in, whether you made it or not?
So yeah, when they make you wait, you know, like 2-3 weeks. I think I was in L.A. I went back out to L.A. and they said they're thinking about it. And then they called my manager and said, Lauren's in L.A. next week. And so he wants to meet with Jimmy in his office at Paramount Studios. And, you know, at that time, I had a car and I drove onto the lot in Paramount Studios. And it's a beautiful, it's like The Godfather. You know, that's where they shot The Godfather. And you see that Paramount, it's an old school Hollywood studio. It makes you feel like you're in the business. It's so cool to go into that lot. And I remember walking into Lauren's office and everything was white. It was very kind of perfect. And I walked in and I sat across the desk from him and he was like, Jimmy, do you wear wigs? And I was like, and I misunderstood. I thought he meant, because I was spiking my hair up at the time. So I go like, oh no, I do this to my hair and I, you know, I can do it anyway. I can part it to the side. You know, I don't know why I was so nervous. And he goes, no, what I'm saying is, do you do characters? Because, you know, what I'm saying is we want you for the show. And it was just so silent after that and slow motion and so emotional. I don't really remember the rest of the interview with him, but I remember leaving and going, I hope I make you proud. Wow. And leaving. And then I went to the first payphone I could find and called my mom, and I just lost it. I was like, wow. I was like, dude, I got it. And we were both crying, and it was great.
She must have been so proud.
Oh, it was great. She was so proud. My dad, my sister, it's the American dream. You don't even believe that this could happen from a small town. I had no connections. My family was not in the business. No one I knew was in the business. You know, it really went down, and it was just like, all right, so now I'm coming back home to New York triumphant, you know, and I'm so happy.
You were like a student of the show, a super fan. You'd seen practically every episode. You'd done impressions of almost every character had been on it. Like, all of a sudden, you are now on a show with your heroes, people that you've been watching the season before and studying. I mean, I can't imagine the pressure that, you know, I once saw like an interview that Bill Hader did talking about how nervous he would get before Saturday Night Live. Just so nervous, you know, because I guess over the loudspeaker, they'd say, you know, 10 minutes till we're live on national television. Yeah. 5 minutes, we're live on national television.
It is a live television show.
Live from New York, it's Saturday Night!
You know, broadcast that to millions of people, which is rare. They don't do that anymore.
No.
But it, just hearing Don Pardo say your name gave me goosebumps.
It's Saturday Night Live.
I could only picture it in my brain, but for him to say, like, Jimmy Fallon, you know, or to watch him do it. You know, even if I wasn't in the show, I was just so happy. Sometimes they would actually cut your picture and name out of the opening credits if you weren't in the show. I mean, how cruel is that?
But when you had to go on stage for the debut in 1998, I mean, were you okay with that? Were you scared? Did you butterfly? I mean,
scared, yeah. Butterflies, it was my first ever gig. Was I played Gilbert Gottfried. I did an impression of Gilbert Gottfried. It was a great premise. It was the Hollywood Squares, except there was an earthquake in Hollywood, and it all crumbled. The squares all, it was a disaster. But they kept playing the game. So it was all crumbled and there was blood everywhere. But they were like, I want to take Fran Drescher to block, you know. So I was Gilbert Gottfried and I was covered in blood and I holding my intestines or something, you know. And I go, my line was,
I am holding my entire intestinal tract in my own hand. And that's not good.
And that was my first line I ever said on Saturday Night Live. And it got a big laugh. And I go, oh, my gosh. And I was it. And I was like, cloud nine, the best thing, best night of my life. After party, my manager there, my parents were there, my sister was there. Every comedian you know, from everyone was there. They said, oh, you're the kid that did Gilbert Gottfried. That was good. And, you know, the internet was starting at the time.
Yeah.
And so there was like an SNL site that they would review the show and be really, you know, hard on the show. And they said, this new kid, Jimmy Fallon, did a great Gilbert Gottfried. He's got promise. And, you know, I printed those things out and clipped them out and kept them.
One of the things that I guess sort of happened to you was that you really, I don't know if you sought him out or it just happened that Lorne Michaels kind of became a really important mentor. I mean, you were all of a sudden you're in New York and you're starting to get recognized and, you know, eventually you get very famous. And he, I guess you really kind of sought out his advice and mentorship.
Yeah, you know, when you first are on the show, you're very kind of intimidated and scared to talk to Lorne. I just didn't want to be fired, really. That was my thing. I'm like, just don't get fired, man. Just stay on for, you know, two seasons and that's great, you know? And so, but at the after parties, Marcy Klein, I give her credit for this. She was like, will you go over and say thank you to Lorne? I go, I just don't want to bother. She goes, Jimmy, go over right now and thank him. I go, okay. And I would go up to Lorne at his table and he'd be there with, you know, you name it. I mean, Paul Simon, you know, whoever, someone's sitting there and you go, thank you. And he'd go, okay, well, you did a good job or something like that. And I go, okay. And then through the years, thank you became like, Lorne, great show. You know, I'm sorry I messed that, but this could have been better. That was all right. And he's like, no, that was good. And he did that. And then it got to Lorne, hi, thank you. And he's like, come sit down. And then you're sitting at the table. And then now by the end of it, it's like every party I'm sitting at the table. So it's Lorne and I talking about the show and, you know, and then your friends and you go like, oh, my gosh, I can't believe what happened in 3 years compared to how nervous I was. But I think, you know, no one's that intimidating. You know, it really, everyone wants to in this business, I think, you know, they want to see it work. They're nice. Yeah. He's so smart and they just want to be around fun and funny people. So we really hit it off, you know, and we became really, really, really good friends. And he's like one of my best friends right now.
All right. So by 2000 or the early 2000s, you become like a staple on SNL. You're in like a bunch of different sketches and you're doing tons of impressions. But at some point, did it just become a job or were you still like, you know, this is amazing. I can't believe I'm here.
Yeah, I mean, I you reach a certain part where, again, you start peaking and you become a favorite of the show. And then you start, in my head, I started getting into too many sketches. You know, they were just throwing me in sketches just because, you know, people would want to see me. And they weren't necessarily...
Because people want to see you laugh.
That became a thing at one point. Yeah, I mean, I'm an easy laugher. And so I would break a lot, but not on purpose. And it started with Cowbell, you know, because I was out of my league. I was out of my league in that sketch. And
I just can't even hear that word, those words in that laugh.
I remember.
It's so funny.
Here was my thinking. And I was in this sketch, and it was one of the funniest things, you know. Yeah. But to be honest, it wasn't that funny when we did it at dress rehearsal. And it was in the Wayne's World section of 8H on the stage, which is... it's famous for Wayne's World now, but at the time, it was also famous for where sketches go to die. So if you have a sketch in that section of the stage, it usually means you're going to get cut. And so I think they just thought it was funny that there was Cowbell in Don't Fear the Reaper, you know, if you look at the liner notes. And I was the drummer.
Don't Fear the Reaper.
You know, Christopher Walken was the producer, and he had to keep coming out and go like, guys, that take was okay, but...
I could have used a little more cowbell. So, let's take it again. And Gene.
Yeah.
Really explore the studio space.
I was like,
time.
Okay, I'm going to do something that no one's... Because really, we're lip-syncing the song, you know? I was like, I'm going to do something that no one's done.
I like what I'm hearing.
And I remember I had drumsticks, and I was like, Yep. And I go, I'm going to count off with my sticks. Like, I go, all right, here we go. Like, and then lip sync. And I go, that is, people are going to say, Jimmy, that saved the sketch. It was so real that you did that drumstick stupid thing that I thought was so funny. And then what happened was, of course, the unplanned, which is we made it to air, and everyone was the funniest version of themselves they could have ever been, ever. Chris Parnell, Chris Kattan, Horatio, Christopher Walken wasn't even sounding like he was speaking English. He was doing such an impression of Christopher Walken.
I got a fever, and the only prescription is more cowbell.
Will Ferrell wore a smaller shirt on air, so when he lifted up his hands to hit the cowbell, his gut like fell out of the bottom of his under this thing, and it was so funny that it was like hot almost. Like, I remember the temperature being hot in the room, and I remember I had one line like,
could be so selfish, Gene.
And Will looks at me and he's sweating, and I saw the eyes of a crazy man. And I just started laughing. I just thought, this is the funniest thing I ever saw. And then I remember at the after party, you know, everyone's like, cowbell was funny, that was good. And then they go, yeah, I don't, you know, Jimmy, don't do that. You know, we don't do that here, you know. I don't like people breaking. Like,
yeah.
And I go, I'm sorry, I didn't do it on purpose. I you know, I just thought it was funny. And they go, right, yeah, but you're in the sketch. You're not watching the sketch. We don't need you to laugh.
It's amazing that the cowbell, more cowbell sketch became one of the historic sketches. It's one of the 10, you know, best known sketches in Saturday Night Live history. I guess you started, once you started to really become like a fan favorite on the show, you started to get a lot of pitches to be in, to do films and other projects. And I guess it got to a point where it just wasn't sustainable. You could not do Saturday Night Live and films, and so you left. To 2004, you leave the dream job after 6 years to pursue this film career. I want to ask you about your acting career, because
part will be short. I want to hear the music on this part. Cut to sad music playing behind me. Now this is where we get
producer,
sad.
Producer, make note. Bring the sad music on.
Yeah, my movie career. Yeah.
It didn't last long, but it was, part of it, it seems to me that you kind of decided that you didn't really want to pursue it, because it wasn't that long, right? I mean, it can take some time before you make a film that, right?
Thank you, guy. Yeah, it was not that long. I left Saturday Night Live going, again, I want to be Eddie Murphy. I want to be Belushi. I want to be Bill Murray. That's what you learn from Saturday Night Live.
That's the path.
That's
right.
What they do. Yeah, you do that, and then you do movies. And so I was just really picky about my roles and what I was going to do. And then I remember somebody said, "Dude, you got to do something, or else you're going to miss the boat." And I chose Taxi because Queen Latifah just had a hit with Steve Martin, and it was the most successful film of all time in France. Taxi.
Wow.
Yeah, I think they made like 4 of them. So I was like, okay, if this hits big, I'll do 4 of these. This is a franchise. It's not even like, it's Jurassic Park of comedy. It's like, oh, this is like, wow, this doesn't happen. So I did it, and we had so much fun doing it. I just put all my eggs in that basket. I should have done 3 movies and just hoped that one hit, you know? Instead, I put everything in a Taxi, and when it came out, it just tanked, and I was starting to film my second and final movie, Fever Pitch. And, you know, once Taxi didn't work, everyone kind of got cold feet, and it was like, oof. And you kind of get like a stink around you in Hollywood, like, oh, he's not the guy we thought he was going to be. He's not Eddie Murphy. And so when Fever Pitch came out and that didn't open, I was like, oof. What am I going to do? I have no, I had no plan.
Yeah. You know, it's interesting because every failure is hard, especially while you're experiencing it. But In every case in every interview I've done on the show, every failure has been a gift or a blessing.
That's what I thought you were going to say, yeah, because it's tough, and it's an ego check. It's a really...
Yeah.
It's a confidence zapper. I mean, oof.
But you specifically had to do that. I mean, you met your wife on the set of Fever Pitch, the person that you would spend the rest of your life with and that you create a family with. Like, that would not have happened if you didn't experience that.
Oh, yeah.
Those 3 years of failure.
Correct. I mean, I've made so many great friends from that, and memories from that, and Drew Barrymore. But the biggest thing, yeah, my wife, Nancy Javonin, was the producer of that film with Drew. And that's where we got the spark, and we just loved, we used to hang out almost every night for months. Not dating or doing anything, just hanging out. She was so interesting and beautiful and different and smart. And I go, I've never met anyone like this ever. And then, I didn't want to get fired. I didn't want to do anything. So I didn't do anything while we're filming. But then we're selling the movie and promoting it. And I said, man, I miss you. You know, I missed hanging out. She goes, I miss you too. And I go, well, let's hang out. You know, like, and she's like, okay. And then we just started just dating then, you know, and I was, wow. And then, yeah, she stuck with me through the dark periods and, still motivates me and to do whatever I do and get me to keep going, keep moving forward and trying stuff, you know, and you need that.
When you, when Lauren Michaels sort of approached you to think about maybe doing late night Conan O'Brien was going to, be moved to the earlier hour. Did you think that, because I would have thought, oh, this is awesome. This is an amazing opportunity. I mean, it's a late show. It's on at 12:30. But did you think it was sort of a step backwards, or did you think that it was a huge opportunity, or what did you think about it initially?
At the time, I didn't want to do it. I was leaving the show. I was going to do movies, and that was my goal. Yeah. I didn't want to do a sitcom. I didn't want to do television. I was like, I'm a movie guy. And so I remember leaving, and Conan O'Brien was promised to take over The Tonight Show from Jay Leno in 6 years' time or something. And so I was leaving, and Lauren goes, would you ever want to host a late night, because you could take over Conan in 6 years. If it doesn't, and I go, and we were kind of laughing. Like, I don't know if he was joking or serious. And Tina Fey was in the office. She goes, you'd actually be good at that. She goes, because you talk to all these people. You go to bars and you just talk to them. It's like, I mean, you love talking to people. I think you'd be great at it. And I go, yeah, well, I don't know. I mean, my movie career waits, and it just didn't work out. And then, I had a couple years where you just go like, I don't know what to do. And then I got a call from Lauren. And he goes, do you remember when I asked you if you want to take over for Conan O'Brien? I go, yeah. And he goes, do you want to do that? And I was like, let me think about this. I have to ask my wife because I'm married now. So I asked Nancy, and I'm in LA, and she goes, are you kidding? Yes, you have to do this. You have to do this. Jimmy, you're on a list. There's David Letterman, Conan O'Brien, and you. That's it. There's only three people. No. That's an amazing list to be on. You have to. And so I said, I called Lauren. I go, yes, I want to do this. And he's like, okay, great. Now I just got to convince NBC. So NBC didn't want me for late night because the movies didn't work and I wasn't hot, And so they wanted other people, and they were going to give it to someone else. And then I remember Lorne just stepping in kind of and saying, look, I know Jimmy, I know his work ethic. And if it's not Jimmy, then you don't have me as a producer. I'm not going to produce. He really stepped it up. And I remember him doing that. And then they got serious. And so Jeff Zucker at the time was running the network. And I had meetings with Jeff. And then he was like, you know that this is a lot of work, right? I go, yeah. Yeah, he kept asking me that, like, do you know it's a ton of work? I go, yeah, I know. Jeff, I mean, please. I mean, at this time, I didn't want to say it, but again, now I'm desperate, man. I don't know what I'm going to do. I mean, this is opportunity. It's unbelievable. And to take over for Conan O'Brien, who's fantastic. I'm his biggest Conan O'Brien fan. He was my first late night talk show,
Yeah.
And so I'm going to do whatever I think I have to do to make this show a hit.
When we come back in just a moment, Jimmy talks about how he comes up with new ideas, whether he's working on a bit, a book, a new show, or a new product that you never knew you needed. Stay with us. I'm Guy Raz, and you're listening to How I Built This. Hey, welcome back to How I Built This. I'm Guy Raz. So, it's 2009, and Jimmy has just become the host of Late Night on NBC. A few years later, he'll graduate to one of the most coveted jobs in television, host of The Tonight Show. But Late Night is where he really begins to build a personal brand. When you started hosting that show, one of the things that you really did and became kind of a signature of what you do is just singing with famous people and getting them to do things that are just unbelievable, like getting Paul McCartney onto the show to sing Yesterday, but to sing about scrambled eggs. And how did you do that? How did you convince people to do those things?
I don't know. I just think at the time in my brain, that just made sense. Like, that's something they should do. And, you know, and you go like, I have an idea if, you know, if Paul McCartney is like, this would be funny. What if he went back to his original recording of Yesterday with his words that he, you know, wrote down, those scrambled eggs, and we just finished the song, and the whole song's about food. And, you know, and so I kind of pitched it to him. He was on Saturday Night Live, and I went into his dressing room, and he's so nice, you know. And I go, hi, Paul. He goes, hello, Jim, you know. And so I go, well, I got this idea. And he goes, okay. He goes, well, can you sing it for me? And I go, oh, my gosh. You know, I didn't plan on. So I go, okay. Okay, so I had the script. So I'm like, scrambled eggs. Oh, my darling, how I love your legs, but not as much, you know, whatever. And all of a sudden, he's playing his guitar, the one that he played yesterday on, and singing with his head right next to me, looking at the lyrics. And I'm freaking out, and I could tell he's into it. He's laughing.
Wow.
And I go, wow. Oh, my gosh, this is going to be fun.
Four. Scrambled eggs. Oh, my baby, how I love your legs. Not as much as I love scrambled eggs. Oh, we should eat some scrambled eggs. Waffle fry. Oh, my darling, how I love your thighs. Not as much as I love.
And so then that moment just kind of happened, you know? And I'm a fan of, giant fan of Paul McCartney. So he knew that it was coming from, I'm a fan, you know. I'm not just looking for a hit and just a gotcha moment, come out, we'll do scrambled eggs, then you split and I don't ever see you again. I'm like, I love you. So I, as a fan of Paul McCartney, I would like to see this. So I think I sometimes come across from that angle as well. Like, they could tell it was coming from a place of joy and fandom, and I wouldn't make you look bad.
You know, one of the things that I have to assume happened in 2009 when you took over Late Night and then, you know, eventually The Tonight Show is all of a sudden you went from being Jimmy Fallon, you've got your agent, you know, maybe one or two people who you kind of work with to overseeing a really large staff. I mean, there's a showrunner, but I mean, all of those people, all of those every single person in that chain is working really hard, but it's up to you to execute. And you're kind of the leader of a really big team of people, and that's a different experience.
Oh,
that's a totally different experience.
Completely, and it's not my wheelhouse at all, and it's not even, you know, it's not even why I got hired, because, you know.
You don't see yourself as a leader? You don't have those sort of natural tendencies?
No, I mean, I definitely do, but, you know, I just know that that's not what got me the job. What got me the job was my work ethic and I think the thirst for entertaining, you know, and trying to make a great party. And then, as like you said, as it grows, you have to start making business decisions and being the manager and running an office. And it's a tricky thing that I'm still learning, but it's curveballs being thrown every day. And it's a lot of problem solving and, you wish you read more Dale Carnegie, you know, than listening to Rodney Dangerfield albums, because I probably could have learned some more.
Still a really useful book, How to Win Friends and Influence People. It's an amazingly useful book. I mean, it's so basic, but it's like, and it seems obvious, but it's so right on.
It is, right? And I never went to business school or studied management or any of that stuff. And it's just almost like life lessons and kind of apologizing before you even do anything. You're like, guys, I don't know how to do this, but let's just see if we can get this off the ground, you know? And I have a lot of support and a lot of help, obviously, but it is definitely, you're involved. I mean, it's a full-on immersion. I mean, it's my life.
I mean, I read somewhere that in your first year on Late Night, you brought in like almost $200 million in revenue for NBC. So, I mean, that's a massive, massive business. I mean, that's a huge success, right? You are the host of this show. It's a really successful business. There are lots of people involved. How do you do so much? I mean, on any given day, you can see an amazing, highly produced video just for social media that you've made, that your team has made, that you're in. And you can imagine how long it took to do that. There's so much work that happens around the actual, beyond the live recordings of the show. There's so much that you're doing. Is your time just beyond your control? Are there people or somebody who essentially tells you where you need to be at all times?
You know, I mean, I have a very great assistant, Kelly Powers, who's honestly, she's the secret sauce, but always keeps me on time and, you know, tells me where I'm supposed to be and all that stuff. But we have tons of producers that are on point and they know how to plan ahead, and it's all planned. I mean, right now, you know, we have sketches and stuff that we're starting to film that will air 2 months from now, just because, I mean, I'm already thinking about next year. I'm thinking about, you know, what can we do for holidays? You know, whatever bits you can think of, the sooner you can think about it, do it now and get it rolling so that you can go like, is this a possibility? Hey, this is a silly idea. Well, you know, how can we get, you know, Elizabeth Olsen to do WandaVision without wardrobe or anything and on a Zoom camera, but still make it with our production and what we could do on our end? And I have a great team and great set designers and costume and wardrobe, and man, did I miss them. You know, when the pandemic, when you did those at-home shows, you just miss all of that. And you go, oh my gosh, boy, did we take that for granted, you know?
But those shows were really special. They were really, really special.
I haven't gone back and watched them, you know, but I should, or because a lot of people come up to me and they go, I love the at-home things. And I go, yeah, I kind of remember just thinking, I don't know how I'm doing all this. It was just me and my wife and me and Nancy. And when that all happened, I went home and my wife was like, well, what's the plan? I go, I don't know. No one knows. We're just, I don't know. I think we're just off until they tell us to come back. She goes, oh, no, you can't. This is when people need you. This is exactly the time when you do not take off. No. Get your phone, get a tripod, and do this. And this is at the time when I couldn't even, it was like kind of almost illegal to drive to a store. It was to get essentials, you know? And so in my head, an essential was a tripod. So I went to like a Best Buy, got a tripod that held iPhones, and then just started doing stuff and putting, I asked NBC if I could put things on YouTube with like a website of a charity. And I just film more and more like hours of stuff and just send it off to our editor, Justin Ulbricht, who would edit from his apartment in Brooklyn to try to get on the air on NBC. And it was like, it was bizarre. It was a real trippy time. And I was trying to think and solve everyone, you know, whatever I could do to help, whatever I could do to get people to think of anything else but this awful pandemic. That was my gig there, and I just tried to make it work.
You know, we could spend the entire episode talking about, like, your entrepreneurial ideas, some of which happened, like pacifiers with dolls attached, or, you know, ideas for, like, magnetized tennis balls or cranberry slices that you put on a turkey sandwich. You have lots of ideas, some of which you've actually – glasses that you can twirl. And then – you know, you have an entire business that's a production company with shows that you've already released that have been, some have been really successful,
yeah.
Shows that you're not in, like The Kids Tonight Show and a new show called Password. I mean, all these things that you are part of. And I wonder, do you, you know, because from the outside, it can seem overwhelming. Like, and I'm sure people ask you this all the time. They'll say, how do you do it? Because is a part of you, do you need to constantly create stuff to just keep yourself stimulated? Is there a part of you that just has to do that?
I think so. I think there might be. You know, I my wife will say it too, like, you know, thank God for the show because I have so many ideas and I don't know what I would do with them. You know, like last night, I just wake up in the middle of the night and I have an idea for when the holidays come around. Like, what instead of Elf on the Shelf, what if it's Elvis on the Shelvis? And so, but he's cool. He doesn't rat on you, you know? Like, these are ideas. I don't know if they are anything. I don't, that's funny, but I could see, you know, Elvis Presley going like, hey, man, you know, so, and there's something to that. And so I love, you know, when I would ever see you and I would just tell you dumb ideas I have because I have just lists. You know, today I thought of someone should create a balloon that's good for the environment.
Yeah, like made out of cornstarch or something.
Yeah. Does it exist? It might. I was thinking about, I'm celebrating my, you know, my wife's birthday, and I'm like, I can't get balloons because, you know, they're just terrible. I mean, it's like,
yeah.
And I go, who has not solved the balloon thing? I go, someone must have. I mean, maybe on Shark Tank or something, but we can have kids' parties and balloons are cool, and actually put them up in the air. Who cares? Let them fly into the ocean. They're good for the ocean. They're fish food.
I mean, you were an actor. I mean, you were a comedian and an actor and then a talk show host. And today, you're all those things, but you've created businesses, production companies, books, television shows that employ lots of people. I mean, you are an entrepreneur. I mean, does it sound weird to hear you describe that way?
Yeah, because, you know, it's just kind of me. I don't have a real, but I guess I do have, I'm so slowly forming a team or stuff, but it's just...
I mean, there's probably... I mean, how big is the staff of The Tonight Show?
Oh, 300 people. Probably, 400 people.
I mean, there's probably 1,000 people who are employed in some capacity because of your work.
Yeah. Yeah, you're right. It's such an honor. I'm so lucky to get to do this, but it's like, what's great about where we film, and you've been on the show, you've seen it, it's kind of an intimate show. It doesn't feel like you're not at O2 Arena, you know.
Right.
It feels small-ish, you know, but still show business. I mean, you're coming through the curtain. It's 200 people, but you don't think you're talking to millions. So to me, it kind of feels like home. Like, you know, I remember when I was on Saturday Night Live, I wanted to sleep on the stage one night, just get like a blanket and sleep. Eventually, someone talked me out of it, but I was gonna sneak down and do it. Just because I wanted it to feel like home. Go like, that's my stage. Like anything, if you can do what you do in your house, in front of people, you know, be that comfortable, that would be the best. So I think it keeps growing and, you know, I don't want to do the same thing. I always go like, what can I do that's something else that I go like, that could be just something fun to do. Again, not thinking about money or can it be a franchise? Can it be something? You go, does someone need this? Is this something that should exist? And I that's kind of where I think of a lot of my best ideas come from.
Can you, like, I'm curious, can you give me an example?
Like, I wrote a book called Your Baby's First Word Will Be Dada because I thought it was funny because I had my first baby and I was hoping that she would say dada first. No one, we didn't have a competition. We didn't talk about it, me and my wife. There was no competition, but there was one-sided competition. I wanted the baby to say dada. So I was like, whatever I could do to get this kid to say dada, I don't care. I was giving like bottles of milk and going like, do you want dada? Do you want a dad? Like thinking that she would confuse milk with dada and want to, you know, ask for dada. And so I made this book just where it's just, you know, animal sounds, quack, you know, and then the adult duck is saying, just say dada. You know, the baby won't say quack. And the cow wants you to say dada. And the calf says moo, you know, and no one says dada. And it took off. And it became a giant thing. And then I started getting videos from people of their kids, them reading the book to their kids, but their kids reading it back to them. And they're saying, like, Jimmy, you've kind of taught my kid how to read. I'm like, no, that is not, I mean, that was never the plan at all. I'm freaking out because this is a reward I did not see coming at all. And it's really rewarding. It's pretty cool to feel like a teacher.
You know, one of the things that I'm curious about is, I mean, you're still, you've got, you know, 25, maybe 30 years of doing it. I mean, Johnny Carson did it for a long time. You're not yet 50. You can do this for a long time. But, you know, there's also a model, which is like Merv Griffin.
Yeah.
He started Wheel of Fortune and like he had this massive production company and he was
Jeopardy.
A major, like major sort of Hollywood mogul. And there's that model too, which is he was a talk show host. He had a show and people thought of him that way, but he had this giant like media business behind him. Is any part of that appealing to you as kind of a model? Because you can do that. I mean, in a sense, what you're doing now could be a version of that.
If it's fun, yeah. I think, you know, there's certain things I can do that I don't do because, I don't know, do I want to have meetings every night? Do I want to have dinner with people? I don't know. I don't feel like that. You know, I kind of like doing my own thing, and at this pace, I can do my own thing but still make the stuff I want to do in the same quality. You know, I think if you get too crazy and, you know, I start coming out with my own line of this and that, and I go, I don't know if I can control all that quality control. And that's up to this point, I think I've done a pretty good job at whatever I've done. It's been a pretty decent quality. And, you know, whether it's a Christmas song or if it's a, you know, silly invention or something or a TV show.
How comfortable, I mean, you mentioned like kind of being a control freak, and maybe that's not the right term. Totally, you know, resonates with me because when you do something that you love and is meaningful and you feel like it's a high quality product, you really want to be involved with it. But, you know, how do you, I mean, your name and your brand, let's say, and brand is a weird word to use around a human, but
no, I get
it's
it.
It's a reality. It's attached to the things you do, whether it's your books or The Tonight Show, which is so high quality, and then all of these shows that you're part of. So Clash of the Cover Bands, That's My Jam, Password, the Kids Tonight Show. You can't be involved, like some of that requires just letting go, right? And letting other people kind of, you know, oversee that brand. How comfortable are you with that?
Not very. And I think, you know, some of the things that I can see, I go, oof, if I did that, I would have done it differently. And I would have, you know, but you have to let people stretch too around you and grow and give people opportunities and stuff like that. But, you know, the key is surround yourself with good people. Get me the best person so we can get to this goal and have a hit, which is rare. It's so hard to have a hit show. You know, That's My Jam was so hard to do, kind of. It's a lot. We, like, had to create a stage and get a budget and book the show and get a good placement when the show comes out. And, you know, are people going to watch because it's up against football, which is the only thing people are watching. And it did well because people could see that it came from a good place, I hope. And, you know, and I think about that when I have my guests on the show. I like a lot of stuff, and I feel like I don't want to come off as ingenuine, you know, like, or like that I like everything, you know. I don't like everything, but I mean, I have opinions on things, but I know how much work goes into this stuff.
Yeah.
And I go like, I know no one wants to make a flop. And this was, you know, 6 months of your life making this TV show or movie or, you know, and sometimes people know when it's a flop. You know, they come on the show and they're like,
yeah,
Jimmy, this one is a rough one. Yeah. And I go, okay, let's go, man. It's part of the business, and I want to be here for the highs, and I want to be here for the lows.
Yeah.
And I think even Miley Cyrus gave me some great advice on my show. She was like, it's all ebbs and flows, man.
She's experienced that, for sure.
Yeah.
As have you.
Yeah, exactly. So don't get too excited when it's going well, and don't get too bummed out when it's not going.
What's remarkable to me about your show is that it is – really, even when you think a show isn't good, it's still funny. There's still really great moments.
No,
it's remarkable to me is the consistency. Like the quality of the show is so high. And you're doing that every single night. We on our team are trying to do that once a week. And I feel a lot of pressure. You know, I want our show to be worth someone's time because I'm asking somebody to give me an hour and a half of their time to listen to the show. And I don't want to waste their time.
Exactly.
And so how does that sort of feed into or inform the way you think about all the projects you do?
I mean, you got to show up. you got to get in early and you got to leave late. You know, the best people do. And if you care, it shows. And it just, it actually, it spreads around the office. And it's like, you know, like when there's bad news about ratings or something, you know, I don't care about that stuff. I don't even care when we're winning. It's like, you know, we had Daniel Craig on the show. We were talking about James Bond, and he got cast as, you know, James Bond, and he got slammed in the press. Slammed. They're like, blonde Bond? How can we have a blonde James Bond and blue? Who is this guy? Yeah. And dude, they trashed him. And his publicist or somebody said, don't read the internet, which is always hilarious to me. That means it's terrible. That means like, everyone loves you, dude, but don't read the internet. It's like, so of course, the first thing he does, he reads the internet. And he said it was so awful and so depressing. And he went to set and everyone had read the internet. And everyone was just depressed around him. And he was like, I got to buck up, man. I'm James Bond. I got to be the leader here. And I got to tell everyone, like, I know you're all reading this stuff, but it's not true. We didn't even shoot a piece of film yet. We don't even know if I'm a bad James Bond. And once he came out of the water, paparazzi got shots of him coming out of the water like James Bond. He was the number one thing. And everyone's like, he's going to be the best James Bond. But it's just interesting how that, like, energy flows. So I think you have to love it, and you have to know that you put your energy into quality and putting the love into it.
But I wonder, when you think about where you want to be in 10 or 15 years, I mean, do you think out that far ahead and think, you know, I think I want to maybe produce a bunch of shows and kind of be on the sidelines and maybe be in some of them? And I don't know, does it ever kind of cross your mind?
I would be lying if I said I didn't think about it, but I don't, you know, I always come to the conclusion that I wouldn't be happy with that. I just think, I feel like I could do this for the rest of my life. As long as NBC and the audience will have me, I will. I think, why not? I think, let's see how good can it get, you know? How good can I get interviewing? I'm getting better every year I do this. And so I think I want to just keep going until the audience doesn't want it anymore. But I think about the history. I think of Leno. I think of Johnny Carson. And I think of Steve Allen. And I go, I think they would want me to go further. And I wish Johnny Carson could see how big The Tonight Show has gotten. Because, you know, that tomahawk was the biggest clip from The Tonight Show, or the potato chip lady, and that was no internet. That existed just from word of mouth. I mean, and re-airing a clip, but I mean, like, imagine, I mean, it's global. There's people from around the world that come to The Tonight Show now. It's like, I want to see how big I can make this, and I want to see how better can I get.
I think I know a version of what this answer might be, but maybe I'm wrong. Because you've kind of hinted at it, but when you think about, you know, where you were and where you started and where you came from and where you are today, I mean, you are probably easily one of the 50 most famous people in the United States, recognizable. I mean, when you just think about where you've come to, who you are, how much of that do you attribute to just the grind? Because you did work really hard. And how much do you think it has to do with luck?
There's a piece of luck, without a doubt. But I think also this drive, and you really have to practice and practice and practice, because you never know when luck is going to come. You know, all of a sudden it happens and you go, well, that was my lucky day. You know, it's funny. I have a picture in my office hanging, and it's two photos. One is Paul McCartney pointing out at this crowd, and the other picture is me in the crowd because I'm the one he was pointing at. And I'll never forget this. It was September 19th. It was my birthday, and Paul McCartney was playing in Brooklyn at Barclays Center, and that's where I was born, in Brooklyn. So I went to the Paul McCartney show, and in the middle of the show, is it someone's birthday out there? Is it someone's birthday? You know, and I go, of course, he's going to play Birthday. You know, you're going to hear the Beatles, and I love that song. And, you know, he probably, you know, he does that. It's always someone's birthday, right?
Yeah.
He goes, yeah, there's Jim out there. And I go, Jim? I go, that's interesting, because he does call me Jim. And he goes, yeah, there's Jim Fallon out there. And I go, what? And then everyone just kind of turned around and kind of looked at me, and I went nuts. And I was like, oh, my gosh. And he goes, this is for you. And he sang, you know, Birthday, the Beatles. And then he sang that, and it's unbelievable. And then he finished. He goes, yeah, that's right. Yeah, it's Jim's birthday. He kept saying it. And I go, oh, my God, this is like a 10-minute bit he's doing. He goes, yeah, happy. And he sang the regular Happy Birthday. The whole Barclays Center sang it to me. And I go, and someone has a great photo of it, and it's me next to Lorne Michaels and my wife, Nancy. And it's in my office, and I go, if I was 12-year-old me or 13-year-old me looking at this photo and go, dude, you are going to be sitting next to your idol at a Paul McCartney concert where he is singing to you, and that gorgeous girl you're married to. It's the greatest photo I could have ever taken or seen in my life.
That's Jimmy Fallon, host of The Tonight Show with Jimmy Fallon and CEO of the production company Electric Hot Dog. By the way, every few months on the show, Jimmy has a segment called Fallonventions. He invites kids to come on and show off their inventions. For example, one kid came up with gloves embedded with small wooden blocks. It allows you to clap for your favorite team at winter sports events. Another kid, a 12-year-old, invented a cat carrier with a plastic slide on the bottom to help pull out the cat safely without getting scratched. Jimmy also showed off some of his inventions, including over-ear headphones shaped like giant ears. Hey, thanks so much for listening to the show this week. If you want to contact the team, our email address is hibt@id.wondery.com. If you want to follow us on Twitter, our account is @HowIBuiltThis and mine is @GuyRaz. And on Instagram, I'm @Guy.Raz. This episode was produced by J.C. Howard with music composed by Ramtin Arablouei. It was edited by Neva Grant with research help from Sam Paulson. Our production staff also includes Elaine Coates, John Isabella, Liz Metzger, Carrie Thompson, Catherine Seifer, Alex Chung, Chris Messini, Carla Estevez, and Josh Lash. I'm Guy Raz, and you've been listening to How I Built This. If you like How I Built This, you can listen early and ad-free right now by joining Wondery Plus in the Wondery app or on Apple Podcasts. Prime members can listen ad-free on Amazon Music. Before you go, tell us about yourself by filling out a short survey at wondery.com/survey.